You're listening to the podcast of the Biopharmaceutical Section of the American Statistical Association.
Statistics.
Hi, folks, and welcome to the show. This is Richard Zink, and you're listening to the podcast of the Biopharmaceutical Section of the American Statistical Association. This is episode 67, and it features a conversation with Donna Lalonde, Christiane Lum, and Leslie McClure. We discuss a very important topic. Our focus today is the Task Force on Sexual Harassment and Assault that was formed by the American Statistical Association in November of 2017. We'll also discuss the forthcoming changes to the ASA meeting policy. Now, before we get started, the 2019 Regulatory Industry Statistics Workshop is September 23rd through the 25th at the Marriott Wardman Park in Washington, D.C. The theme is From Small Data to Big Data, From RCT to RWE, The Impact of Statistics. Registration is now open, and sign up fast. The workshop is already 3/4 full. Now, as a reminder for these discussions, please note that people are sharing their personal opinions, so please don't overinterpret their comments as representing the groups or organizations with which they participate. Now let's start the show. Hi, everyone. Today we are talking about a very important topic. Our focus is the Task Force on Sexual Harassment and Assault that was formed by the American Statistical Association in November of 2017. I'm talking today with Donna Lalonde, Director of Strategic Initiatives and Outreach at the American Statistical Association, Christiane Lum, Statistician at the Human Rights Data Analysis Group, and Leslie McClure, Professor and Chair of the Department of Epidemiology and Biostatistics at Drexel University. Good afternoon to all of you, and thanks so much for being here to discuss this important topic.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Now, to start off, can you give us a brief overview of your current roles and describe how you got involved with the Task Force on Sexual Harassment and Assault? Donna, why don't we start with you?
Sure, thank you. Yes, so I'm currently on staff at the ASA and was appointed by the board to be the staff liaison to the task force. So have worked with the task force since its inception, and will probably continue as we implement. Well, I will definitely continue as we implement recommendations and move forward.
Very good. And Christiane, how about you?
I am not actually involved with the task force at all.
And Leslie, how about you?
I was appointed as the chair of the task force by the ASA board. And although technically the work of the task force has come to a conclusion, I'm still working with the task force members to prepare some information for the ASA community about the work of the task force.
Okay, very good. And we already mentioned that the task force was formed in late 2017. What were the circumstances that led to the formation of this group? Was it something that was building up over time, or was there a particular event or incident that led to the formation?
Yeah, it might be best for me to address this. So, certainly the climate in the country was changing so that there was much more talk about incidences of sexual misconduct in society more generally, but also in science. But the real precipitating situation was at the Women in Statistics and Data Science Conference in October of 2017. I served on a panel in which I was talking about leadership, so not really related necessarily to sexual misconduct, but mentioned the blog that I write. And a couple of the young women in the audience came up after to talk to me about one particular blog post that I had written about my experience with sexual misconduct and assault in when I was younger, and led to a longer conversation about what the ASA could be doing to address these issues. And so, spurred on by that conversation, I reached out to Ron Wasserstein, the executive director of the ASA, and Lissa Lavange, who was the president at the time, and indicated that there was some interest in the ASA thinking more about this topic. And so the response was almost immediate, and there was great enthusiasm to pursue this. And so Ron and Lissa proposed that the group of people who I'd spoken with at WSDS think about what the task, what this task force or this group might be responsible for. And that's really how the task force came about.
And about the same time, I believe it was in December 2017, Christian, you published a blog post entitled Statistics, We Have a Problem, where you responded to some events that took place at a machine learning conference and shared your story of past harassment as a student and researcher. And this particular post received tens of thousands of views and sparked debate in other blogs and social media platforms. So how did this post affect the significance of the work of the task force, or did it? And how did you all take this into consideration?
There's actually hundreds of thousands of views and reads now, which is kind of crazy to me that so many people have taken the time to look at it and that it's circulated so widely. I actually never expected it to sort of take off in the way that it did. So the question is, what sort of spurred me to do that?
Yes.
Is that?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, so I think it actually is somewhat similar to what Leslie was just saying. I think a lot of it had to do with sort of the cultural moment where we were at the time, where it sort of felt like all these things had been, they sort of reached a boiling point in some ways, where it, for years these were things I had really wanted to say, and it just felt like the professional community in the world was maybe ready to hear some of those things. And take them seriously in a way that they hadn't before. And, you know, since I wrote that, I've gotten similar feedback from other people that they had long felt that there was a problem and that they'd experienced similar issues to what I'd described, and that they had also, prior to that time, kind of felt like, you know, maybe you could complain about it, but there wasn't much that was going to be done, or that people weren't really ready to hear it or willing to act on it if they did hear it. And so, yeah, I really think it was just sort of reacting to sort of the cultural moment at the time, and reacting in some ways to, you know, hearing stories about some of the same issues I'd faced, repeating time and time again, and they're not really, you know, appropriate actions not really being taken, and sort of feeling like, you know, if people are ready to listen, this is the time to say it, because maybe this can hopefully move us towards preventing this from happening to other people.
And Donna and Leslie, when I don't know if you viewed this particular post when during the formation of the task force, but were you aware of it at the time? And if so, how did it or did it influence the way the task force sort of approached the mission it was trying to do?
So I think in terms of the work of the task force, the charges were already established prior to the blog post coming out. Certainly everybody on the task force was aware of the blog post, and it certainly informed our view individually. However, we really tried to focus on being proactive rather than reactive in the work we were doing, recognizing that this was a long game and that we were really thinking about how to manage these sorts of instances going forward for generations, rather than trying to focus on events that had happened in the past. So we really wanted to be proactive, to think very broadly about the scope of what people encounter in our field.
I would just add that from my perspective, in terms of how the Christian's post informed my work with the task force was that I think it, well, first off, I really respected her bravery and her willingness to be a voice. But I guess it, as Leslie said, that it reinforced the need for us to think through these issues and really come up with suggestions that and programs that would change climate. So I absolutely agree that it wasn't about addressing any particular incident, but more about thinking this is the time and we should do something.
And I guess I would add that by having such a public declaration, Christiane helped others outside of our task force see that this is indeed a problem, because I do think we faced a little bit of this hasn't happened to me, so this isn't a problem. And so that did help open some eyes a little bit to those who might have thought that we in statistics were immune to these issues.
Sure, exactly. And Leslie and Christiane, you both shared your experiences in a very public way. And as you mentioned, it's a very brave action to take. And you did mention sort of the shift in the cultural landscape, but were there other factors that led you to sharing these experiences in a forum where it's clearly visible that you're the individuals talking about it? And in general, you mentioned some support to the posts, but has there been any negative reactions to them?
I can go first on that. In terms of negative reactions, I mean, mostly no. I mean, most of the people who I've interacted with have been really supportive and really positive about it. You know, of course, I have gotten some random crazy people from the internet sending me crazy emails, and it's only happened a couple times. I sort of removed my email from being easily found on the internet, and that pretty much fixed it. So that wasn't too much of a problem, actually. Less of a problem, actually, than I thought it was going to be. In terms of sort of the reasoning about why publicly and why then, beyond sort of just the cultural and political landscape at the time, you know, I guess I felt like I'd been trying to go through various avenues that were maybe more private for a while, including talking about these things with senior people in the particular community where I had the most problems, and there really weren't pathways forward, even for people who are well-meaning and wanted to help. You know, like there are suggestions like I should become a dues-paying member again, so I could vote against certain people in elections if I thought that they would maybe not use any additional power they had in ways that were appropriate, and things like that, where I really felt like the response wasn't strong enough for me. You know, and that's not to say that I'm speaking against anyone in particular, because I think everybody was reacting within sort of the constraints of what they were empowered to do, given sort of like the bylaws that existed and you know the sorts of consequences there could be. There really wasn't any sort of formal mechanism for doing anything about the things I was talking about. And so, you know, there just wasn't a whole lot of movement towards getting those sorts of things in place. And I wasn't even pushing for that at the time. Like, I didn't even realize how important the type of work the task force is doing was at the time. It just felt sort of like, well, this is the only thing that's left. And again, maybe this is something people are going to be willing to hear right now. And so, you know, it wasn't that I just went from zero to nuclear out of nowhere. There were, in fact, years of talking to people, including relatively senior people in the community, and things just weren't progressing in a way that felt productive. And in fact, I would hear, you know, stories about very similar things happening and continuing to happen. And it seemed like the only remaining option.
Sure. And Leslie, how about you in sharing your experience?
Yeah, so I first actually alluded to my experience in 2016 when I was first talking about my 20th anniversary of attending JSM, but I didn't really spend any time on my blog really getting into what had happened. And I made the comment, I think, in my blog post that perhaps in a future blog I might share a little more about that story. And I had people reach out to me and ask me to do so, curious about what had happened. And I think probably similar to Christiane, that people were feeling that they'd had similar experiences and were seeking comfort, and that there'd be others who might have similar stories. And so I think I just finally felt like I was in a place where I was comfortable enough with myself to share that experience, because I think I had to come to terms with the fact that it wasn't something that I did that caused this to happen. And it took me a really long time to really be in that place. And I think I finally got to the place where I felt like it was okay for me to share. Plus, I also felt like that I'm in a role now, in a position now where I'm not likely going to be promoted again. And if I wasn't able to speak out and I wasn't willing to speak out, then I wasn't setting a good example for younger folks who might be having similar experiences. And I feel like it's my responsibility to do so, that I, and also my honor that I'm able to, speak on behalf of perhaps people who aren't quite so comfortable speaking. So, and in terms of reaction, I also had very positive responses. I was actually overwhelmed by people who reached out to me to thank me for sharing my story, or to apologize on behalf of the ASA or that sort of thing. So it was really, made me feel like there was a safe space for me to share. And I was really glad I did. Again, I wasn't quite so bold. I never identified the person who assaulted me. But maybe in the future I will. I don't know.
Well, thanks to both of you for sharing your stories, and I'm sure that it has helped innumerable people sort of come to grips with their own experiences and feel like that they're not alone in their experience. And Christian, you alluded to this a little bit in talking about going public, and a lot of instances of harassment or assault may go unreported. You talked a little bit about, you know, there's only certain sort of, I guess, parameters that people are able to work within, and it may not necessarily lead to outcomes that are necessarily helpful. But in general, why do you think it's the case that these instances of harass or assault may go unreported or take a very long time to be communicated?
You know, I think there's a lot of reasons, and I think they're probably different for everybody. I think one is shame. I think people are embarrassed about what's happened. I think something Leslie alluded to is, or I guess said directly, is that, you know, sometimes people have a hard time sort of taking some of the blame off themselves. They feel like maybe they deserved it, or they, you know, did something to make it happen, or were in some way at fault, and that, you know, talking about it will sort of invite the types of questions about, well, what were you doing? What were you saying? What were you wearing? Perhaps that would be really uncomfortable and hurtful to even have to go down those paths. I also think there are just a lot of, I think for a lot of people, they felt like, you know, I think I said this earlier, but that people might care, but they weren't going to do anything about it anyway. And so, you know, in that way, maybe it's sort of cathartic, but it ultimately wasn't going to result in any action, or it wasn't going to change anything. And so, you know, why sort of go through the, you know, renewed trauma in some ways of having to recount some of these things to people when they're also powerless. But I think the last one is that people, I think, do in some ways fear for their careers. And it's not so much, I think, that people are concerned someone's going to outright retaliate. Certainly there are cases where people might fear sort of an obvious outright retaliation, but I think it's the more subtle things where you might not be viewed as someone who's fun to hang around at the conference, or somebody who maybe can't take a joke and now everybody has to be super uptight around you and they can't say anything because you're sort of there to like ruin the party or just ruin everybody's good time. I was never really concerned about like outright retaliation or anything like that, as much as I was concerned about kind of receiving the cold shoulder from the community in some ways, like being treated like I wasn't one of them because I kind of said something. As far as, you know, that I've now come to understand, and at the time I thought, and I believe it's confirmed now, at least based on my conversations with people, something that pretty much most people were aware of, but just sort of thought it was kind of how things were. And so, you know, really want to be the sort of whistleblower in that case. So I think there are a lot of reasons why people don't say something in the beginning.
And I think the fear of retaliation is a big fear among particularly junior people when you think about an academic environment in particular, when C senior people are always reviewing your work, whether it's through peer review publications, which may not be blinded, whether it's through grant reviews, which may not be blinded. Tenure and promotion requires external letters, which may not be blinded. And so there are a lot of opportunities for junior people to be reviewed by senior people. And I think there, and it's a very hierarchical type of environment. And I think the power struggles that are inherent to academics really do raise this fear of retaliation.
Mm-hmm. Do you think there are certain things sort of in the examples you provided where just even simple acts of blinding the work could provide some additional support to people who would like to come forward but ultimately feel scared about retaliation?
Sometimes. It depends on the work, because some work is so specific, there are few enough people doing it that just by publishing your work, you're unblinding yourself. And so, right. I mean, these are questions that we addressed in our discussions as part of the task force, and we considered all of these implications very thoroughly. There was a lot of discussion about these sorts of issues, particularly brought on by power dynamics. And I have to say there's a lot of gray in terms of blinding and the implications for, is it truly blinded? And certainly these are issues academics need to think through very carefully and consider implementation of.
Richard, I might just, I obviously have not written as eloquently as Leslie and Christiane, but I guess what... Through the work of the task force and other work that I've done, I think it has made it more obvious and important to me that we also have to think about the structures that we can put in place so that we are creating climates that make this make these kinds of behaviors unacceptable. You know, whether or not we change beliefs is probably a bigger question, but hopefully we can at least create climates where even if people might be inclined to respond in a derogatory manner, it's not accepted, right? So I guess I would want I would hope that's achievable.
Yeah, exactly. And have either of you had cases where, or have any of you had cases where just in trying to report things, you were just not believed?
Yes. I guess I'm thinking of a case where it wasn't necessarily sexual harassment, but I was a situation in which I was experienced harassment by somebody higher up. And the response that I received was, what did you do to get that person to act that way?
Sorry that you had to experience that. Hopefully people would be open to hear what you would have to say without turning it around on you.
Well, so the optimist in me says you learn who your supporters are in situations like that, and you learn who aren't your supporters, and it's mm-hmm. informative, and you learn from it, and you make decisions based on that learning.
Right, right. No, I think both of you discussed examples of harassment at one of them was obviously at JSM, and one was at a different kind of statistical event. But people may be unfamiliar that these kind of events happen at statistics conferences at all. But how many instances of harassment or assault have been reported to the ASA office in terms of the meetings that the ASA runs?
Well, actually, we don't have any reported, but I suspect some of that has to do with the issues that Leslie and Christiane have already dealt with. Is that folks somewhat feel that making a report might be that making a report would be futile. That said, one of the works that will come from the task force is that we now have at JSM and other meetings and an ombuds process so that people can make anonymous reports to an experienced ombudsperson and can be helped through the process of what should be the fallout from the report. So I suspect that if you ask me that question next year, Richard, I'll be able to provide a different answer. So one of the things that the task force and of course the support of the board that we can be very proud of is that I think that the ASA is actually leading the way in terms of having this kind of reporting system that is both anonymous but also has the support of an ombudsperson to help mediate the conflict.
And by way of some data, so one of the tasks that the task force was charged with was doing an assessment of the frequency of sexual misconduct or harassment at ASA-sponsored events and in the field more broadly. And so the ASA contracted with Langer Associates to help administer a questionnaire that went to 15,000 ASA members and 3,500 responded. So that was about a 22% participation rate. And what we found was that about 1% of respondents indicated that they had experienced some sort of sexual misconduct at an ASA-sponsored event, whether that was pressure for sexual favors or rape or sexual assault or attempted rape or sexual assault. So approximately 1% total for those different categories. But we did see as high as about 11% of respondents that experienced disrespect or condescension based on their sex or gender. So we may not have extremely high rates of sexual assault or misconduct, but the task force feeling was that anything non-zero was too high.
Sure, certainly. What were the goals of the task force and what rules or programs did you hope to have in place? We talked a little bit about, I guess, the anonymous reporting. Is this through an email or a link on the website or what other tools are being made available?
So broadly, the charges for the task force were to assess the extent of sexual misconduct in the ASA community, review current best practices of professional organizations and academic institutions with respect to sexual harassment and assault, consider the creation of a resource, which you alluded to, that allows victims to anonymously receive support, and then make recommendations to the ASA board describing what we'd found and what the feeling of the task force was with respect to what the board could do going forward. So in terms of products, the ASA sponsored event conduct policy was revised and has figured more prominently on the ASA website. So we use information and data from other organizations to inform our modifications of the ASA conduct policy. And we solicited input from ASA membership broadly and allowed for anonymous feedback. And it was adopted in November of 2018. By the ASA board. So that was the first actual product that came out of the task force. The second product that came from the task force recommendations was the addition of the ombud service at ASA-sponsored meetings, which Donna had already mentioned. And then we made a list of recommendations to the board regarding processes and procedures for anonymous reporting of sexual misconduct, and then also for suggestions as to how the ASA may handle any reports that are received, and including best practices that we found from other organizations. And I'm going to turn to Donna to give an update on the board's process for reviewing and implementing those at this point.
Right. Thank you, Russ. So the report was received in January, and discussions occurred at the April 2019 board meeting, and and out of those discussions, the board is now working on a document that will be be shared, obviously, with the community to articulate what sanctions should be in place should there be a finding of harassment or misconduct. The other action that the board took was there was a new consortium of societies was formed on sexual misconduct in STEM, double M, including mathematics and medicine. And we are an inaugural member of that consortium. So building on the work that the task force did in terms of making sure that we were aware of best practices and rather than having to reinvent wheels, that we could be working together with other societies. So I suspect that we will have more to say on the results of the board discussion after their meeting at JSM.
And I just want to add that all of the reports that have been generated as a function of the task force are being made publicly available. And so there will be links to those in the upcoming AmSTAT news article that the task force has shared, including the full report from the Langer questionnaire.
I would add that the information about how to engage the Ombuds Service at JSM has been will be added to the activities conduct policy, and obviously will be included on the JSM app and will be shared with via the JSM community.
And you mentioned sanctions against individuals. And I guess this still has to be discussed at JSM, but what does that mean exactly? Is that being banned from future events or being, I guess, kicked out of ASA? What exactly does sanctions mean?
So my understanding is that the board is considering a range of different options depending on the action that has been undertaken. But I will say, as these discussions have gone forward and thinking back to the discussions the task force had, that there are a lot of shades of gray. So it's unclear to me how something that happens at someone's academic institution should then be perceived by the ASA, for example, or something that happens at a different conference should be perceived by the ASA. I know the board is doing all they can to try to ensure a positive culture going forward and that there are consequences that are in line with the actions that might be taken. But it's very difficult. Our experience as a task force was that it's very difficult to delineate all the possibilities that might arise and the severity of them. So again, I look to the board for their guidance on this and look forward to hearing and learning about what their conclusions were.
And in terms of the individuals who may experience these sorts of actions, so certainly they will have an ability to report it. Will there be, I guess, information available about, say, counseling services or other things if they needed to go in that direction, or
that's actually all a part of the Ombuds process, which is why we are so invested in moving in that direction. The focus of an Ombuds engagement is to bring resolution, whatever that resolution will look like, given the individuals involved.
And the recommendations of the task force were very clear about the ASA implementing procedures and processes that do their best to protect the person who's making the accusation in terms of their privacy as well as their reputation, to ensure that the process would be as smooth for them as possible, recognizing that these are difficult situations to be dealing with for the parties involved.
And I guess I would just add to that that's why the board is so committed to the engagement with an external entity with experience, because they recognize the potential within the community for folks to be unwilling or fearful about making a report if that report had to go to a member of the community. I think we'll have a strength in that regard.
Certainly. And you may have touched on this a little bit, Leslie. So obviously, I think all of this work that you've done will apply to ASA events. But will individuals be able to make use of any of these services, say if an event was to happen at another conference for an organization that wasn't part of the larger community that Donna was talking about, or if it took place at their workplace or a university, for example?
I don't know the answer to that, actually. I'm not sure. Donna, do you know how that would, the process for which my inclination is that if it takes place in a university, that it would get referred back to the Title IX office at the institution. Mm-hmm. But other than that, I'm not exactly sure what the process would be like.
The reporting will be open, and it will be open eventually. It will be on the website and will be available at times other than the conferences. So I guess it would be the opportunity for someone to report an event at another that wasn't an ASA activity. But I think that would then the sort of the action on that would really be outside of our purview. That said, we would want to make sure that the person who made the report was treated fairly and understood what options he or she or they had. Mm. I guess that's kind of a waffle answer, Richard, to say that I think we will probably have to figure that out somewhat, sort of where, as Leslie's mentioned, the gray areas, and I think that's sort of one of the gray areas is where does one draw the boundary between ASA activity and a related activity. But I guess I would say that's one of the, I think the benefits of other organizations coming together in consortia, but also sort of seeing the new policies at NSF and at NIH, I hope that collectively all of our initiatives will create an environment where people feel like they do have resources.
Sure. So, yeah, I think it's good that, you know, if the ASA has done this in a very methodical way and has very clear policies, you know, to protect individuals, and it may not necessarily feel like at their place of business or at the university that those resources may not be available to the degree they may be at the ASA. And certainly you can, through the ombud person, that they would at least have some resource available to go in a useful direction. So, but yeah, I guess I can understand that it would be a gray zone right now in terms of not knowing how it would be used. At the 2018 JSM meeting in Vancouver, there was an invited session on this topic of sexual assault and harassment and the work of the task force. And I think one of the very interesting aspects of that invited session was that you conducted a live survey depicting several scenarios, and participants were asked to record whether or not they thought particular scenarios would be considered harassment or not. And perhaps not surprisingly, there were many differences based on the male and female participants in the results. Why do you think this is, and what can we do to improve or this disparity between men and women?
And sure. I'll just say that I think that if we redid that survey a year later, that there would be fewer differences, maybe still some, but fewer, because I think that there's a lot more awareness now, whereas I think that there's, unless it's happened to you, I think people have a hard time believing that in our community, where they know a lot of people and are comfortable, that these sorts of behaviors can happen. I also think that we have to shift culture, and we're shifting culture to help people understand better what constitutes harassment and assault. And I think that not having a clear understanding of that could lead to some of these disparities.
Yeah, I don't know that I have much more to add to that, but I guess I would say that I think sometimes we aren't reflective enough, and so we don't realize the extent to which our actions could be hurtful. That's why I think that it's really important to have programs in place. I'm a big supporter of ally training. I think that it's really important for me as a friend to know what I can do to support my colleagues. And I feel like that might help also eliminate the perception of differences.
And with the advent of the Me Too movement, sexual harassment and assault have received a lot of visibility, and there have been many entertainers, researchers, and politicians who are now being held accountable for their past actions. And how do you view the efforts of the task force in the context of this larger movement? Do you think that perhaps if the environment had been what it was, that the task force would have happened at all, or been as successful, or received as much support from the ASA community?
Well, I'm going to take the rose-colored glass view and say that I do think that all of the complementary activities and reports have helped make a stronger and perhaps more cohesive message, but I feel like the group of folks who are on the task force and with Leslie's leadership were so committed to building stronger community that absent any other external support, they would have moved forward. And I feel like the board is equally as committed. So it's a little hard to look in the crystal ball and say what the results would have been absent the support of other reporting bodies and research, but I feel like we would have made progress even if others had not been making progress.
And I want to reiterate the strong support that the task force has gotten from the board and the leadership in the ASA. Specifically, Ron Wasserstein, as the executive director, has been extremely supportive and very passionate about ensuring that we had opportunities to be successful as a task force. So again, I agree with Donna, it's hard to say what would have happened had this climate not been changing in the society more broadly, but I'd like to believe that the strong support that we got from within the ASA certainly would still have been there.
I think in response to some of the Me Too movement, there's been individuals or organizations that perhaps flippantly remark that gender should somehow be segregated in some fashion as a solution to issues of harassment or assault, and or certainly seen examples or read about examples of male professors saying that they wouldn't take on female students or limit interactions. How do you respond to these scenarios where people aren't willing to sort of take these issues seriously enough to at least listen to what's going on?
Well, we certainly have to be cognizant of the effect of a backlash. And being in a field that's predominantly male, although that's changing, we certainly have to be careful that we don't lose the seat at the table that women have started to have. Now, that said, to those who say, well, I'm not going to take female students anymore, or that we should segregate by gender, I would say that if you're not doing anything wrong, then you have nothing to be afraid of.
Donner,
yeah, I would absolutely agree with that. And I guess I would go back to what Leslie described the work of the task force. She said we want it to be and the ASA, we want it to be proactive. And I think the approach is to just continue to be proactive and provide people with the tools and resources. So those comments are just minimalized.
You know, in some ways, in a lot of ways, actually, I understand that people might see what's going on and be fearful that they might be subject to some sort of false accusation, or maybe have their actions that taken the wrong way or something. And so I guess, you know, it is hard because, you know, when you were talking about the sort of procedures that the task force is putting in place, we were talking a lot about fairness, people who are reporting. I think, you know, it is also important, and I'm sure you guys are doing this, but that the procedures are also perceived to be fair to the people who are accused as well. And I'm hoping that that will alleviate some of those concerns.
Yes, absolutely. And we talked in our report, and when we spoke with the board about it, about ensuring that this is a process that's fair to all parties involved and that's confidential for all parties involved.
And I think our commitment to begin the process engagement with an ombuds really speaks to that, because the ombuds philosophy is not about assigning blame. So the ombuds philosophy is about conflict resolution, again, whatever that might look like. I mean, eventually it may get to the sanctions stage and blame will be assigned, but it won't be the starting place.
And I guess the fact that this individual or individuals will be independent of the ASA, that it's sort of operating outside of it, and it would limit other people within the ASA or larger statistical community to knowing what's happening. I get.
Yeah. And it will hopefully limit conflict of interest and limit bias. But I also want to go to Christiane's point. You know, the task force had a lot of conversations that really made me stop and think about my interactions with students and faculty, and are there levels of inappropriateness in what I'm doing, whether intentionally or not. And so I think that just having these conversations about what is appropriate, is it wrong to have coffee with a student? Is it wrong if you're of different genders? Is it wrong to meet with your student over a beer? A lot of these conversations are helping all of us think in ways that we hadn't thought before. And so just starting these conversations, I think, helps people look at this from a different lens, and that's really important.
Yeah, and I guess I would just add to that although obviously the work of the task force has been on sexual misconduct and harassment, and therefore maybe more focused on gender, I think one of the benefits of the task force that will have effect on the broader community is making us realize that there are we are a community that has many, many different components, and that, you know, we need to think about and be sensitive to those differences.
Absolutely. And I think you mentioned this earlier, Leslie, that essentially the work of the task force has been completed. And while there may be some work left to do at JSM in terms of the board approving different recommendations of the task force, how long do you think it will take to get all the pieces in place? And do you think there may be a time where the task force may need to reconvene to address different issues?
So that's a great question. So I first would say that I hope that this work is never done. I hope that there's always opportunities to be introspective and for our community to assess how we're doing things and whether we could be doing them better. I think that going forward, there will be opportunities for other ASA committees to be involved in some of the recommendations that the task force has made, perhaps because it's already within the charge of their committee, or it's in the purview of their committee. We've also had discussions about who's responsible for ensuring that these recommendations are carried out, or that the board continues to do this. We have differing views across the task force on many issues. And I think that's what made our recommendations stronger, was that we did have so many different perspectives. And Donna alluded to the fact that we all brought different experiences. But I think that we agree that the ASA membership also has to take some responsibility to ensure that our leaders are moving us in the direction we want to go. I don't know if the task force will be reconvened in the future if issues arise that the leadership feels that the task force would be best poised to address. That, I guess, that remains to be seen. I just want to mention that the task force has been an incredible resource and that it's been an amazing experience. There's a diverse group of people who all put themselves out there and really shared their experience and helped to better the ASA through our shared experiences. And while I was fortunate to be able to lead this, the work really couldn't have gotten done without each of the members.
Yeah, and thanks to all of you for sharing your experiences, sharing the work of the task force, and moving the ASA in a direction that will make a more positive experience for all of its members. So thanks to all of you, and thanks for talking with me today about all of this important work you've been doing.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
And there you have it, episode 67 on the Task Force on Sexual Harassment and Assault. I hope you all learned something from this conversation. I know I did. And I hope each of you takes the time to reflect on how words and behaviors can affect other people. Be mindful of it at work, at school, and at home. Finally, if you have an idea for a podcast or have a question, send me an email at rzink@targetpharmasolutions.com. That's RZINK@targetpharmasolutions.com. Until next time.